At Planet Fitness, we're declaring it. This is the year of getting stronger, and you can get started now by saving when you join today. We have all the best-in-class equipment you could ever need, and you can work out your way on your time at any convenient location near you. Most open 24 hours. So let's do this. Join Planet Fitness today and save. Just $1 down, $15 a month. See Home Club for details.
Welcome to the Gravity Podcast, where we host conversations on developing a Christian spirituality rooted in love that fosters resilient faith in everyday life.
Welcome, one and all, to the Gravity Commons Podcast today. I am your only host for the intro, Ben Sternke here. Both of my compatriots, Christy Penley and Matt Tebbe, are away for different reasons and unable to join me. So it's just you and it's just me, listener. I want to get a few things off my chest while I have the chance. No, I'm just kidding. I don't really have much in the way of an intro besides kind of who we're talking to today, David Gushy, but I also just wanted to mention, in case you've missed it, you probably haven't, but I wanted to mention that you can join us in Denver at Theology Beer Camp this year. Matt and I are going to be there. I think Christy may try to make the drive up from Colorado Springs for one of the days, perhaps. Not totally sure if she's going to be able to join us, but I would invite you to join us. It's October 17 through 19. I think it's a suburb of Denver, Highlands Ranch. It's a United Methodist church there that this is all going to be hosted at. And Theology Beer Camp, we've never been there, but we're really excited to go. There's a lot of other podcasts in the same vein as Gravity that are going to be there. It kind of brings the whole shtick of the conference / gathering is that it brings together theology nerds and craft beer for a blend of intellectual engagement and community building and fun. If you listen to our episode with Trip Fuller, you will probably get an idea of how fun he can be as kind of the host of the gathering. So it's organized by Homebrewed Christianity, which is the organization and the podcast that Trip runs. And there is a lineup of well-known podcasters and scholars and theology enthusiasts who come together to kind of nerd out. But also the other thing that I appreciate about Trip and about Homebrewed Christianity is that it's not just nerding out in an academic sense, but it's really a gathering that cares a lot about the church and it cares a lot about Christian witness in the world. So anyway, we're excited to be there. Brian McLaren is going to be there. Diana Butler-Bass is going to be there. Ilya Delio is going to be there. Jörg Rieger, Catherine Keller, a bunch of other folks are going to be there. We're excited to hear from them. Oh, Tom Ord is going to be there. He's been on our podcast. Grace G. Soon Kim, we recorded an interview with her. I'm just looking through the speakers here that we haven't published yet, but she's going to be on our podcast as well. Brian Zond is going to be there. He's been on the podcast several times. Pete Enns is going to be there. He's been on the podcast. Anyway, I'm really looking forward to it. One of the cool things about Theology Beer Camp is that you can't come and be a speaker unless you're willing to stick around for the whole event. And so it's not a kind of drop in and, you know, drop your speaking engagement and then fly back out kind of a deal. It's more of a let's come and hang out and listen to each other and converse over craft beverages. There are the non-alcoholic kind as well, if you would prefer that. So anyway, I'd invite you to join us if you can, October 17 through 19 in Denver, Colorado. You can find all the info and get your tickets at gravitycommons.com/theologycamp. gravitycommons.com/theologycamp. That'll forward you to the registration page. And please use our code. If you go and you register and you're planning to come, use our code, which is GravityHobbit, all one word. All caps. I don't know if that matters, but Gravity Hobbit is our code. And if you use that code, you get $50 off registration. So join us in Denver. That'll be a lot of fun. All right, let's get on to our conversation today. We are talking with David Gushy, who has also been on the podcast before. He's back to talk with us about the moral teachings of Jesus. And I really appreciated this interview because this is his new book. It's called The Moral Teachings of Jesus, Radical Instruction in the Will of God. And actually talks quite a bit about how the moral teachings of Jesus can help those who feel that maybe the old version of their faith is no longer working for them. I think the moral teachings of Jesus, he writes in this book, are kind of a gateway into a more examined and more robust faith. Because honestly, a lot of the reason that a lot of us are frustrated with the faith that we grew up in or the communities of faith that we inherited the faith from is a lack of seriousness about the moral teachings of Jesus. And so this book, in this book, he examines 40 teachings of Jesus that are all drawn from the four New Testament Gospels to clarify what Jesus said about the moral life. So the Reverend Dr. David P. Gushy is Distinguished University Professor of Christian Ethics at Mercer University and Chair of Christian Social Ethics at Free University Amsterdam, and also the Senior Research Fellow at International Baptist Theological Study Center. Gushy is the elected past president of both the American Academy of Religion and the Society of Christian Ethics, which indicates his role as one of America's leading Christian ethicists. He is the author, co-author, editor, or co-editor of more than 28 books and has had a global impact in the field of Christian ethics. He is a leader in the growing post-evangelical movement, and he has also put feet to his faith in several activist campaigns. David and his wife Jeannie live in Atlanta. He is a classic novel reader, a world traveler, and tennis player, and awaits a call from his beloved Atlanta Braves to resume the baseball career that he abandoned in college. Let's get into it with David Gushy.
Dr. David Gushy, welcome back to the Gravity Commons podcast.
Thanks, Matt. Good to be with you again.
David, last time we chatted, we were talking about a book on Christian ethics. And this time we're discussing a book on the moral teachings of Jesus, which has ethical implications, obviously, throughout the book. I wonder if you could just speak for a bit about sort of your life work in the ethical realm, talking about morality and ethics, and how that topic sustains your attention. How do you not get tired of it?
What a great question. Well, vocation is the simplest answer to your question. I discovered the vocation of Christian ethics when I was in seminary, and it has never let me go. And that was 40 years ago. I just suddenly realized how old I am. So I'm just going to pause there and recover from that for just
a moment of silence for David. Listening.
David, if you would reflect on end of life ethics with us for a moment.
Yes. That's hilarious. So once I discovered Christian ethics in seminary, it was like, oh, this is it. Mm-hmm. I am called to help Christian people think about how we live our lives. Mm. And that's endlessly interesting to me. And I get to do that in classes and at churches and in writing. And there's a spillover work because I'm also sometimes we speak to the public, speak to policymakers or to newspaper reporters or whatever, but the heart of it is sitting in rooms with Christians helping us think about how do we live this life faithfully to Jesus. So it has sustained my attention for sure, because for one thing, it's this fabulously rich conversation that has been happening over 2,000 years. Historical sense helps. The materials that we get to work with, the scriptural and traditional materials, are so rich, diverse, and challenging. And the issues that we face all the time are evolving and demanding and complicated. So how could I not stay interested? Now, at some point, I'll just run out of steam, but it hasn't happened yet. So,
well, I'm really grateful, actually, for this book. The moral teachings of Jesus. You organize this book around the four gospel books, basically: Mark, mm-hmm. Matthew, Luke, and John. As you explore different ethical implications of Jesus's teachings, like marriage, divorce, and kids, and loving enemies, and mammon. We'll get to some specifics a bit later, but first, what prompted you to write this book now, and like the structure of it, breaking out the different gospel writers as each having a voice, giving voice to what Jesus's morality was?
Well, I'll start off with a variant on the last question. I did consider doing biblical studies as my PhD, and this is my most serious effort to do a book that could be cataloged as a New Testament book, not just a Christian ethics book.
Yeah.
So this was an effort to do something that is always dangerous for a scholar, which was to kind of edge a little bit outside my field. Moral teachings of Jesus should be in the field of Christian ethics, which it is. But if you're looking at the Greek and reading New Testament commentaries and comparing what biblical scholars say, you're doing New Testament scholarship. And so, I mean, that's really what that's new. What motivated me, almost always it's students. So I had students at the seminary here in Atlanta who asked me, would you revive a class that's been sitting dormant in the catalog for a while called The Teachings of Jesus? And how do you say no to that? No, I prefer not. My choice is to not do The Teachings of Jesus.
Yes.
I refuse. No, so I couldn't do that. And so to develop a class, I find that developing a class from scratch is not all that different from developing a book. And some of my books have come out of class development. Hmm. And so partly this is the product of putting notes together for a class. Right. But also, big picture, and you saw it in the intro, I feel like there's a gap in how much people who claim the name of Jesus are paying attention to Jesus. I think that's a problem that you see on the right. It's a problem that you see on the left in different ways. And I thought, let's just dive in. Let's just, in essence, go from Matthew 1:1 to John 21 and see what's there. And as you mentioned, I do end up organizing the book in terms of Mark first. I have 9 teachings that I feature from Mark. If it's in Mark, I usually start there, and then to Matthew, then to Luke, and then to John. And I have a section at the end on Passion Week with some accounts that appear in various Gospels. But I'm excited about what finally resulted. And I'm glad you noticed that I'm trying to be honest about how each Gospel writer tends to have at least a modest editorial slant. And so New Testament scholars will say, there's the version of Jesus we see in Matthew and the version of Jesus we see in Luke and in Mark and in John. And there are nuances there. And so, but on the other hand, it is also the case that you have teachings that appear in multiple gospels in substantially similar forms with some variation. And so I try to keep in balance that we're dealing with something that he actually said that is passed on and then finally gets written down in slightly varying forms in multiple gospels, and trying to deal with the nugget of the teaching that appears to be what he said, as well as the editorial emendations or situating that the authors of the gospels give us as well.
David, I wonder if you could double click on that just a little bit, maybe flesh it out. Give us one tension or conflict that you discovered between the gospel authors, or a tension between what Jesus teaches and then how the rest of the canon handles ethical questions. Could you just maybe pick one and
One example, I'm glad you asked that. One example is the teaching on divorce. Mark gives us a teaching that basically says no divorce and remarriage is adultery. Now that is not a welcome word. I don't think it was a very welcome word in the first century, and it's definitely not a very welcome word now, right? Matthew has the account of the conversation a little bit different. But Matthew gives us no divorce except for porneia. So then we get to figure out, what does porneia mean? Sexual immorality, sexual sin, or there are other theories. And then it appears to teach that remarriage is permissible if divorce is permissible, but that itself is disputed. Luke just gives us one long sentence to summarize it, and it isn't the same as either Matthew or Mark. So you have it, you have clearly, and then Paul, by the way, Paul appears to know a teaching of Jesus against divorce. And Paul is reflecting on that teaching in 1 Corinthians 7. So that's an example where you have the tradition passing forward a rather stern teaching from Jesus on divorce. And a basis for that teaching in which he goes back behind Deuteronomy 24, which mentions the certificate of divorce being able to be written, mm-hmm. and goes back to Genesis when Jesus says it was not so from the beginning. He quotes Genesis about marriage. So I think that Matthew is editorializing, perhaps functioning like the house pastor or the house rabbi, saying, well, the standard is no divorce, but if there is some sexual immorality, then there may be a way out, and here's what the grounds are. And it becomes more of a legal ruling, which is, so it's a different flavor. You don't have that kind of thing all the time, but I think that's a really good example of a difference.
Yeah, thank you.
And by the way, the church has argued about divorce ever since, partly because those teachings are similar and yet different. And so different traditions in different eras, the churches have had various approaches to when divorce might be legitimate and how to adjudicate that and all of that. And it really goes back to these variations in these texts right here in the Gospels.
Yeah.
We'll be right back.
Respero. Hey, we've talked about them before. They're an organization that offers faith-based counselor training. They believe that the aim of counseling is real transformation, not just symptom management or removal. Their counselor training courses equip you to help people to be great lovers of others, to understand why they do what they do, to be emotionally healthy, and to live out their identity as someone deeply loved and delighted in by God. All their training is rooted in the belief that Jesus is a source of life and that we can be a part of his work of healing and restoration.
And for pastors and ministry leaders, their training is a proven way to identify the people in your church who might be gifted for lay counseling, and it can be a powerful way to help make your church into a genuine healing community. They provide all the training and the supervision that allows your leaders to do great work and to free up pastoral staff from needing to do all the pastoral counseling in your church. If you are interested, you can go to respero.org, that's R-E-S-P-E-R-O.org, and click on the counselor training tab.
The Gravity Podcast is sponsored by the Gravity Formation Course, a 12-month cohort-based training in practical spiritual formation, where you'll learn to notice how God is already at work in your life so you can participate more fully in the life God shares with us. It's a discipleship process that goes beyond just gaining more knowledge and trying new practices. In the Gravity Formation Course, We go below the surface of our lives so that we can notice and name our deepest desires in God's presence, and to discern how God is at work in those desires to lead us towards holistic flourishing, more transformation, more life, more joy, more love. We've trained hundreds of people all over the world in this formation framework, and it has helped many people to have a sense of God at work in their lives, to learn how to be more at home in God's love. If you'd like to learn more, go to gravitycommons.com/formation.
Let's get back to the show.
You know, divorce brings up, the way I've always taught that text and, you know, sermons and that kind of thing, is that like divorce nowadays is a very different kind of thing than divorce was back then. It had very different implications, especially for women, you know, that kind of a thing. And so I wonder if there are ethical questions then that Jesus considered important that maybe not as important for us or not as pertinent to us today. That might be kind of a weird thing for people to think about if you're going to take Jesus seriously. But Jesus was also, you know, a man who lived in first century Palestine. Yeah. And so I don't know if there are some things that come to mind, can you name one or two of those, and what does it look like to then follow Jesus? What does it look like to receive those moral teachings that are less important today? Maybe, how do we receive them faithfully if they don't directly apply to our context?
Anybody who is offering moral instruction, who is a human being, even if we also believe he is divine, is operating in a context,
right?
A religious context, a legal context, political context, a cultural context. And so actually, when one is dealing seriously with the teachings of Jesus, the Jewish context of Jesus becomes very significant. And then you have to try to unpack, what was the Jewish context of Jesus? What was first century Galilean and then Palestinian Judaism under Roman occupation with the different parties? What exactly were the Pharisees and the Sadducees and the Herodians and the Essenes? You have to do all of that. And what were the understandings of Jewish law that were in conversation? And not all of that is especially relevant to 21st century Detroit or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. But I try in the book to draw some broader applications. So, for example, to what extent do we understand morality as having a law-like structure? To what extent do we say, like, no, we don't do this because it's against God's commands or it's against God's law? Some Christian traditions still use the language of law long after leaving Jewish law behind. Other Christian traditions don't use the language of law at all. It's more like, it's looser than that. It's more like goals or vision or aspirations or principles or something, thinner or weaker. So one of the things I say is, I do think, on the conservative side, the tendency to keep a kind of a law-like structure to Christian morality lasted at least into my lifetime. And in some remote quarters of the Christian world, Christian morality still has a very much a law-like structure. You shall not, period. Mm-hmm. Many people listening probably would know of that kind of what we might now call legalism, right? And sometimes it was clear, like, we do not commit adultery, but other times it was more like, we do not wear blue jeans to church, or we do not get, women do not get their ears pierced, and men certainly don't, because, you know, in other words, sometimes there were laws and rules that really had little to do with the Bible, but they just got added in there. But I would say, okay, so legalism is a problem, but we also have parts of the Christian community where sometimes the opposite problem seems more compelling, where we don't really have any clear standards. We don't have anything that really binds us. We leave people without adequate guidance. Mm-hmm. And so seeing how Jesus wrestled with Jewish law, we can reason by analogy to how do we wrestle with the law-like structure of moral obligation? Or is moral obligation law-like at all? Another example, I remember when I first became a Christian, the pastor taught, and it was widely agreed, it is essentially a religious moral obligation, a law to tithe. And the tithing campaigns that happened every fall, the understanding was there is a rule here, 10%. Okay. I think far fewer churches feel comfortable teaching that today. But so then it might be more like give as you feel called or give generously or give something. You see how that's a lot less clear than tithe. It also helps to explain why there's maybe a lot less giving than there was. I don't know. I'm an ethics nerd. I'm interested in, like, do we think of moral obligations as having a law-like character, or are they something else? And if so, what are they? Things like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I was just recently asked to fill out a reference for somebody who was going to seminary. And on the reference, it asked me to rank the person's morality.
Oh, dang.
And it was like superior, good, average, not below average or something. I was like, what? First of all, define, what are you talking about? And then how am I supposed to do that? That seems bananas to me. So anyway, as you were talking, I was just thinking, oh my gosh, like, it's important to kind of understand, like, what is being talked about? What is the wise way to live? I don't know. There's better ways to kind of get to maybe what they're really asking in that question. But
boy, and the first thing I would do if I saw a question like that is I would look at the letterhead to see who is asking me that question, because embedded in that and is an entire religious subculture.
That's right. Yeah.
Well, maybe we can explore a couple of the specifics in your book, David, just to give our listeners a flavor. You have a section on the Beatitudes, and so much has been written about the Beatitudes. But I'm curious, sometimes people teach the Beatitudes as though Jesus is affirming or ascribing moral categories, right? So it's virtuous to be poor.
Right.
Or it's virtuous, right, to suffer. And I wonder, how do you handle blessed are the poor? And what can we learn from this morally?
I'm thumbing through my not as beautiful book manuscript, because you actually are holding, you have the actual book and I just have pages. I continue to take an eschatological reading of the Beatitudes that Jesus is saying the kingdom of God is dawning, in which the world and its messed up values is going to be turned upside down. Blessed are you who are ready. And the ready are described as the meek and the mournful and the poor in spirit and the peacemakers and those who, you know, that kind of thing, who are single-minded. Let me see here's how I conclude that section. Matthew's Beatitudes offer words of affirmation and promise of divine reward for a newly forming community poised in readiness for the reign of God. Jesus is saying, here on this mountain, I have found my team for God's kingdom. I celebrate them, and now I will get them ready for the hard but beautiful work that lies ahead. So blessed are you. You are here because you are ready for the good news that the kingdom of God is breaking in. Here are the kinds of people who are ready: those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, those who are single-minded for the will of God, those who are humble, those who see the brokenness in themselves and in the world, those who are peacemakers, those who are merciful. It's like Jesus is saying, your hearts are already soft and already broken and already ready for a new kind of world. Come join my team and let's make it happen. That's what I think is happening in the Beatitudes.
Yeah. Ben, How's that strike you?
It strikes me good.
I love the readiness.
Yeah.
And I think also too, there's a contrast there, David, that mm-hmm. is you're implying, or it's like subtly in the background of that, the present age, the present world order, none of these groups of people stand to benefit.
That's right. That's right. One of the things that became very clear to me, and it's why I subtitled the book Radical Instruction in the Will of God, is that I think Jesus sees the structure of the present world order, of the present age, as entirely upside down from the will of God. And so to up is down and down is up. What is honored is not worthy of it. What is dishonored should be honored. It's everything. What is valued should not be valued. What is not valued should be valued. He's constantly revaluing and turning things upside down. And in the conclusion of the book, I actually pick as my tag verse, totally surprised myself, the one in Luke 16:15, where he says, what human beings honor is an abomination in the sight of God. I think a lot of Jesus' teaching is about honor and about valuing. And I think what he's saying is basically what you folks honor and value is upside down from what really should be honored and valued.
You know, one thing that is honored, valued, and worshiped is mammon. And, yep. you know, many of your chapters deal with money and wealth and mammon. If you had to summarize in 1 or 2 minutes Jesus's like ethical teaching on mammon, how would you do it?
I think he would say everybody needs enough to meet their needs and the needs of their loved ones. Mammon is what happens when our desire for money or the things that money can buy goes way beyond need to idolatry. And the life devoted to the acquisition of wealth usually carries with it a deepening of all of the distorted valuing that I was just talking about. So the valuing of luxury, the valuing of status, of honor, of excess, and learning to ignore those who are not so fortunate.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I think Jesus teaches so firmly against mammon, mammon here and being an Aramaic word, that apparently even by the time of Jesus meant money as idol, like a god.
Yep.
And because it is a competing god to the real God who teaches us to value humans, to care about those who are in trouble, to not compare ourselves to other people, to not play status games, and to not honor people on the basis of how much stuff they have. So the mammon is that whole complex of distorted judgments about what matters and about how to treat people. That's what I think is going on there.
That's good. I just had somebody talk about mammon, and I don't know if this is right or wrong, but she said, you know, one way you could kind of test your heart to see how much mammon is growing or taking a seat on the couch of your heart is, what are the last 10 things you spent money on? Just look at your account. And was it on you? Was it on somebody else? Was it for other people? Like, and I was like really challenged by that, because I want to just personally be like, no, I love God and I want to love people. And then you get into the nitty gritty and there was conviction.
Yeah, that's a good word. The other thing that I think is really striking is Jesus totally sees, like his parables about like fancy dinner parties and stuff. He totally sees that we build status systems around money. Mm-hmm. The more money you have, the more you can do with it to flaunt how much money you have and to leverage that for relationships and for power in the community. And the less money you have, the less you can do all of that. And also, when money gets associated with piety, the idea is the richer you are, the better person you must be, the holier you must be. And there was a lot of that going on at that time. All of that, I think, made Jesus sick to his stomach. He thought it was all upside down.
Yeah.
That's why often he talked about the least are the greatest in the kingdom of God. And it's those who were not invited who God wants to have at the party. And he constantly did that upside down thing. And I think he is so right. And I find that deeply convicting because it is almost impossible to live in this world and not have some of that in us. Because we're trained in it. We're trained in it.
Yes. Yeah, David, I wonder if we could just talk about another specific here. And that's the passage, judge not, you know, lest ye be judged. Yeah. You handle that. And I hear often this passage kind of get used to denounce any moral discernment. Mm-hmm. and we know that that's not what Jesus is doing. So what is the kind of judgment that Jesus is prohibiting here? And then what kind of judgment, moral discernment, is he not prohibiting here?
I was really glad for the opportunity to take this up. And I did some, you know, word study here and thought about other passages and so on. And at one level, what he's saying is judge yourself sternly based on the criteria of the will of God. If you are sufficiently focused on purity of your own heart, you won't have the energy to be looking at whatever might be wrong with somebody else. So that's the, you know, get the log out of your own eye before you look to see the speck in somebody else's eye. That is associated with judge not. Also, a broader expansion in that teaching, and it's beyond the Sermon on the Mount, is the idea that where Jesus says, with the measure you give will be the measure you get. And part of what he's saying there is, be generous in your judgments of others if you would like for them to be generous in their judgments of you. And that's an interesting principle of reciprocity. You know, the stern judgmental types who are all the time casting negative judgments on other people invite such judgments from others. So it's corrosive of community. It creates an atmosphere of judgmentalism, and probably many people listening to this podcast will know of churches that are like that. Mutual judgment societies, right? Also, I think it's pretty clear from both Jesus and Paul that there is a kind of judging that we do sometimes where we assume that we know how somebody stands in the sight of God. And it is as if we are pronouncing judgment at the end of their lives. And that, I think, is resolutely banned by Jesus. We do not have that kind of information or power, and we dare not ever make such judgments about the eternal destiny of any other human being. But that doesn't mean we're not able to say, going into a school and shooting children is wrong, whatever other things that we know are wrong. We have to be able to make moral judgments. And yes, it is true that judge not has been wielded now as a kind of a weapon for antinomianism. We cannot have any rules because Jesus says, judge not.
Right.
That's a mistake.
Yeah. David, your last chapter deals with the passion, the passion week of Christ. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about why you made that its own specific section. I think a lot of us approach the passion narrative as, oh yeah, these are the facts about how we got saved. You know, here's Jesus going to the cross, but you make a point of putting it in, you know, a book called The Moral Teachings of Jesus. And so, what is it about the Passion Week that makes it sort of stand apart as a picture for us in moral instruction?
What I did in that last section of the book was to look at three scenes in the last week of Jesus' life. We know that according to all the Gospels, he goes into Jerusalem on what we call Palm Sunday, and he's dead by Friday. And in the intervening days, it appears that he occupies the temple, that he has the crowds with him during Passover week, and his enemies are poised to strike, and he is occupying the temple. So part of what I do is to talk about Jesus occupying the temple for a week. It isn't just that he cleanses the temple. He takes control of it for a week. And I'm interested in the things that he teaches there, but also the very fact of his relationship with the temple and what he says about it. So that's one thing. And then I decide to isolate the teaching that he offers under pressure related to, is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar or not? And I think as an ethicist, I'm especially interested in that teaching because it has political implications. And it also was a real tightrope walk for him during his ministry. If he's asked, is it okay to pay taxes to Caesar? It seems like there's no good answer. And his answer of render to Caesar the things that are Caesar and the gods the things that are gods has been being argued about for 2,000 years. And so I try to get into that conversation. And then I culminate the book with, besides my conclusion, the last one is the Matthew 25 judgment parable, the sheep and the goats judgment parable. In Matthew, it's the last thing that Jesus teaches before his crucifixion. I had another interviewer say what that did for him was it reminded him that he was taught that the culminating teaching of Jesus was go into all the world and make disciples, Matthew 28, the Great Commission. But that if we take this framework, the culminating teaching of Jesus during his earthly ministry is, as you did it to the least of these, you did it to me. Yeah. And I think that has some interesting power to it.
Yeah.
I don't have I was tempted, but I don't have a section on the meaning of the cross itself. I just decided that was outside of my scope. But I do have Jesus in the temple, surrounded by enemies and by fans, walking a tightrope every day with Roman soldiers around him and zealous Jews from all over the world. And he's being asked these questions. And I wanted to isolate that week because it was different than the rest of his ministry.
Yeah. And now a word from a sponsor.
At Planet Fitness, we're declaring it. This is the year of getting stronger. And you can get started now by saving when you join today. We have all the best-in-class equipment you could ever need, and you can work out your way on your time at any convenient location near you. Most open 24 hours. So let's do this. Join Planet Fitness today and save. Just $1 down, $15 a month. See Home Club for details.
All right, let's get back into our conversation.
Maybe a little bit of a side, like a tangent here, but I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about it. You know, you're an ethicist. You're writing about the moral teachings of Jesus, but then you say that, you know, especially this last week, that some of Jesus' moral teachings have these political implications. So I'm wondering if you can maybe parse out what's the relationship between, for us as Christians, morality and ethics, and politics. Is there a way of talking about those things where they relate to each other? Are they the same thing as each other? How would you talk about that?
Well, just to as an example, to pick up on the taxes to Caesar teaching. I would say that the moral teachings of Jesus are about how to please God, the God who is the one who deserves our loyalty and our obedience. And Jesus was single-mindedly focused on doing the will of God. So that is the religious ethics of Jesus and of the Jewish tradition out of which he came. But meanwhile, Jews who were attempting to do that were also living in the Roman Empire with a whole political regime that had different assumptions and asked different things of people. And so in essence, you might say that it shifts to quote unquote politics when it has to do with the worldly empires and worldly regimes and so on within which Christians live. How do we relate to them, to their enticements, to their threats, to their way of looking at things, to the things they ask us to do, the things they demand of us? And as soon as we realize or recognize that we are simultaneously attempting to serve God and give God everything that God rightfully requires of us, and to keep body and soul together and to properly live in kingdoms that have, that do not have that vision, that ask other things of us. In essence, we're in the realm of competing kingdoms, competing demands, competing loyalties. So like this election season, I'm going around speaking on my last book, which is about democracy, and I'm trying to help Christians think about how do we function as democratic citizens? How do we think about voting in November of 2024 when the kingdom of God is not on the ballot, but the short-term future of the United States of America is? What does that look like for us? What should we be voting on? And I've been emphasizing protecting democracy as a political system because it's preferable to the alternative. So that's politics. If that project should fail, if we end up living in a dictatorship or something, it is still the case that the next morning Christians would be waking up asking, should be waking up asking, how do I serve God? How do I do the will of God? What does it mean to be faithful to God? In essence, the political kingdoms in which we live and how they organize themselves, they're the context in which we live, but they do not get our ultimate loyalty.
Yeah.
That's helpful.
I think that's a good arena, Ben, of the question that Christy asked earlier. You know, Jesus and his people's relationship to the government in a monarchy, is imperial monarchy, is different than our relationship to the government in a representative democracy. And so it's hard to draw like a straight line. You know, people like to quote Jesus, render what to Caesar what is Caesar and to God what is God's, as it relates to taxes. But taxes do different work now. We actually have a say, some kind of say in our taxes now. And so when you just drag and drop these principles, you actually don't even value what the moral teaching is doing, right?
In its original context.
Yeah.
And then you can't understand how to maybe apply that in a way that might look a little different because we have a very different political context. So
yeah, that's really true. And it helps. It always helps to situate as much context as we know. There was a lot of resentment on the part of the Jewish people, especially in Palestine, about having to pay any taxes to Caesar at all. I mean, why should we pay you for the privilege of being dominated by you? We never invited you anyway. And so tax revolts were an ongoing challenge. And there was a major tax revolt in Rome that was a factor later after Jesus' ministry. And I think Paul in Romans 13 was talking about taxes too, in part because he wanted to encourage Christians not to do tax revolts. So all of that is context that we should know about. But yeah, when we elect the people who write the laws that impose the taxes, the context is very, very different.
Yeah. There's so many wonderful chapters in this. It's going into my, you mentioned New Testament studies. It is going on my commentary bookshelf, not my
Ethics
bookshelf.
Oh, yes, Matt. So yes, I don't know, David. Happy news. I want to see you right now. I want to see you lift up the book and put it in that special section. No, that's okay.
Yeah. I'll need two hands and I'll need to put on some special music. So we'll have to do it after the interview.
There's a whole liturgy for it. It's really a thing.
Yeah. I'm actually glad that comment was received as a compliment because it could have gone either way with an ethicist. You know, if you tell them that the book's going on a shelf with a commentary, they may take an umbrage at it. But
no, that's high honor. High honor.
The book is great, David. Your ethical, the way you look at, we're almost out of time. Can I just, you brought up a school shooting.
Yeah.
And we're taping this in the shadow of another mass shooting at a school. As you think through the moral teachings of Jesus, in the public square, typically Christians want to wave their hands and talk about thoughts and prayers. Yeah. They also want to talk about how this is just a fact of life. Guns you will always have with you, I think is how they quote Jesus.
Yeah, he often said that. Yes,
he did. Yes. I wonder what If you were to bring a couple passages from Jesus into how we think about school shootings and guns, what one or two texts would you want to put towards the center?
I have a very, very, very soft spot in my heart for children. And I think one of the more unique dimensions of this book is my exposition of the things Jesus said about children.
Yes.
How much he valued children, how much he honored children, how he saw children had insights. For example, the way children are very unlikely to play the status games that adults play, right? That's part, I think, of why he said children were closer to the kingdom of God. You have to receive it like a child. And he also said, don't cause these little ones to stumble. So that the passages related to children come to mind in a couple of ways. In terms of the shooters, who is it in their families or in the online space or in their world that is helping to distort their thinking in such a way that they would even consider doing this?
Yeah.
Who is causing these children to stumble? And then when I also think about I think I saw a number this week, 382,000 American children have now been directly affected by gun violence at school. We are charged to protect the innocence and vulnerability of children. Jesus talked about, woe to you if you are the one who causes a child to stumble, better to be, thrown into the river or whatever with a millstone tied around you. We are ruining, damaging the childhoods of thousands and thousands of kids. Woe to us that we can't do better to protect our own children. Even the children who are not directly affected have to do these shooter drills.
Yeah.
So his overall concern for the vulnerable, his willingness to challenge any center of power that did harm to people, and his special solicitude for children, those are the passages that come to mind.
I just appreciate so much about seeing the shooters as children to whom harm was done.
Something has gone wrong there. And, yeah, this one this week in Georgia, that's 40 miles north of where we live here in Atlanta. Wow. I've been by that high school. And I saw the boy being arraigned today, 14 years old, lost kid. All the early testimony is that a lot of bad stuff happened in his childhood to help get him to the place where he got. He still bears responsibility and will be held accountable, but 14 years old. Children killing children with weapons of mass violence that somehow people are putting into their hands.
Yeah.
So that's what comes to mind. There is some creativity involved in taking modern situations and applying ancient texts or taking ancient situations and seeing about modern implications. But I guess what I'm calling the church to is immerse in the teachings of Jesus as deeply as you can so that the way we look at the world can be formed by the vision of Jesus rather than by other alternative visions.
Yes. David, this work is important. Your voice is important. In a world where we have platformed Christians talking about turning the other cheek with derision, we desperately need an ethic that's centered in the life and teaching of Jesus. I wonder, as we close, could you speak a bit about the work you do with the Post-Evangelical Collective? What is it? How'd you get involved in it? And how can people find out about that?
Yeah. It's a 4-year-old organization that is attempting to network people together who are on the other side of evangelicalism. It's attempting to start up and help to sustain post-evangelical churches, to equip pastors, to provide intellectual support, to provide a context for artists who can help to write the music of this next new era in the church. It's at postevangelicalcollective.org online. I'm on the wisdom board, which means I've been asked to help advise these mainly younger pastors and leaders to think about how do we go from here. I know this, evangelicalism is shedding exiles and refugees left and right, and some of them are lost to Christianity or to the church forever, but some of them are finding their way to post-evangelical churches, and the Post-Evangelical Collective is, I think, the leading organization trying to help to support that space. I have a lot of respect for the people I'm meeting in this world. I get to speak in a lot of their churches. Mm-hmm. By the way, there's a map of a vetted churches that fit with the values of the PEC that can also be found on that website. Maybe if you're listening and you want to go to postevangelicalcollective.org and look at the map of churches, maybe you can find your way to one of these churches, or let them know that you're already out there and you'd like to be named as well. I'm a pastor. I was called to be a pastor before I was called to be an ethicist, and they go together for me. I want to help people follow Jesus and not give up because of the bad stuff they've encountered in previous churches.
Same here. Thanks for your work. The book again is called The Moral Teachings of Jesus, Radical Instruction in the Will of God. David, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you so much for the invitation.
Well, you guys, I don't know if this reads when you're just listening, but we record these podcasts kind of on a Zoom-like interface, so I can see David and those kinds of things. We can see each other. It helps, I think, conversation. Sure. I like David.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He makes me think better. Yeah. And he also challenges me to live, I think, more holistically for Jesus.
Yeah.
I appreciate his affect, his disposition, his the way he takes up space. He's very generous and kind, and it's obvious that he is. I love it when the smartest guy in the room doesn't need you to know it.
Yeah.
Yeah, he is. There are people. I love all of our guests, but there are people that you meet. I mean, this happens in real life too, doesn't it? There are people that you meet where there is something about the way that their character has been shaped and formed, or the way that they've allowed God to maybe transform their lives, is a better way to put it. That does just, they just end up exuding just a level of strength and gentleness, kind of both together, that very much appreciate the way that David is with us every time he comes on. That's his second time, though. It's only his second time on the podcast, right?
Yeah, just twice.
Really, really appreciate him. There's others that we've had on that I've just been like, oh, this feels nice. It's nice to be in this person's sort of digital presence.
Yep.
He briefly mentioned the whole idea of maybe the culinary teaching of Jesus being like, do unto the least of these rather than the Great Commission. Mm-hmm. And I got to chew on that. Mm-hmm. And what does that, how would that change things? Does that change anything in ministry and or in the way that you, as a pastor, I think, anyway, it's just fascinating to think about.
Or at least maybe changes the flavor with which, because there's a lot of ways to go into all the world and, make disciples.
Yeah.
There's a lot of ways to make disciples, and so maybe that changes the posture with which you make disciples. Maybe that changes everything.
Yeah. Fun fact, the Great Commission wasn't the Great Commission until hundreds of years after Jesus.
Right.
Meaning it was not called that, or
it wasn't considered called that, and the church fathers didn't talk about it the way we do.
Yeah.
And the dominant sort of assumption is that the apostles fulfilled it. Now, this is why Paul was raising money to go to Spain in the book of Romans, because Spain was the end of the world. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. And so whether or not he made it, the assumption was somebody made it, mm-hmm. and we did it. Yeah, we did it, guys. Mm-hmm. Now, that's not to say we shouldn't
make disciples.
I'm just saying, like, the way that we use the Great Commission would have been strange to the early church.
Yeah.
Anyway, I also wanted him to talk more about the temple being Jesus occupied the temple.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I like that. I thought of the Occupy Wall Street movement. Do you guys remember that?
Was that
the early aughts?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
99%. You know, they were literally, you know, tents in what park was it? It was a park right outside Wall Street.
Right by the bull.
Yeah. Anyway.
Well, it was great.
Similar kind of political action.
I love it. Before we go, Christy.
Yes.
Knock, knock.
Who's there?
Me.
Me who?
Just me. Hi.
Just making sure you remembered who you're talking to.
It's just me. Just,
okay.
Yeah, I was just coming to say hi.
Thanks, Matt Tevi. Appreciate
you're welcome,
the hello.
Christy.
Matt's still trying to mix up how this
He's
goes at the end.
Me.
He's trying to fool you. What does this say about
fool me
you
37
as a person?
Times? Yeah. Shame on you. Yeah. Fool me. All right, everybody, have a good rest of your day, no matter when you're listening to this, and you'll catch us back next week.
Peace.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Gravity Podcast. If you're finding it helpful, please tell your friends about it. Word of mouth is the best advertising. Ratings and reviews online also help others find the podcast. And don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. To join discussions about the podcast and lots more, join us in the Gravity community. It's free to join, and you can connect with other listeners to the podcast to talk about faith, spirituality, and whatever else comes up. Also, Ben and I hang out there a lot. To join, go to gravitycommons.com/community. The Gravity Podcast is produced by Ben Sternke and Matt Tebbe. Aaron Sternke edits and mixes the podcast. You can check out his mixing, engineering, and production work at aaronsternke.com. And we'd love to hear from you. To record a question or comment for us, go to gravitycommons.com/message and click the Start Recording button. You can also email us at podcast@gravitycommons.com. Catch you next time.
At Planet Fitness, we're declaring it. This is the year of getting stronger, and you can get started now by saving when you join today. We have all the best-in-class equipment you could ever need, and you can work out your way on your time at any convenient location near you, most open 24 hours. So let's do this. Join Planet Fitness today and save. Just $1 down, $15 a month. See Home Club for details.